Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by the Audio Information Network of Colorado, dedicated to providing accessible content for all. Find us at aincolorado.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for June 14th, 2023, reading of the Model Railroad Magazine. My name is Kevin Harvey. Today we'll be reading the following main article, Animate a Coal Mine by Jim Furness. And then we'll follow up with some miscellaneous articles. Animate a Coal Mine by Jim Furness. Spinning head frame wheels add to the realism of this HO structure. Monarch Mine Number 2 on my HO scale Colorado and Southern Northern Division needed a tipple structure to cover its coal loader mechanism. The tipple had to include the massive timber head frame found on the prototype. I also wanted to animate the hoist cables and sheave wheels at the top of the head frame. The coal loader is the twin of the one I described in the July 1999 issue of Model Railroad magazine. Wedged just into 6 inches of space, the plan shows the tight track clearances that require precise positioning of the tipple. I primarily used styrene and strip wood to build the tipple. Adding animation increased the visual impact of the compact rail-served industry. Even if you don't model this specific coal tipple, you can adapt the techniques shown here to other model projects. Getting started. Working from the plan on the next page, I drew each tipple wall full-size on paper and tested it on the layout before committing to styrene. After building a wall, I cemented it to the growing tipple at my workbench and checked the tipple on my layout. I then drew the next wall. I scratch built the tipple from 0.040 spaced metal siding sheet styrene, which is evergreen 4526. I splice sheets together with styrene cement to form the larger sides, ensuring a good match between adjoining groove patterns. I reinforce the splice joints with styrene scraps cemented to the back. Next, I marked and cut sides from the larger sheets along the window and door openings. I scribed horizontal lines every 13.5 scale feet to represent sheet metal courses. I started with the tipple's shaft enclosure, building it as a strong spine with plenty of bracing to withstand handling between my workbench and layout. I built the rear wall from heftier 0.060 plain styrene sheet evergreen 9060, since it wouldn't be visible against the backdrop. I cemented the rear wall to the shaft enclosure with 0.100 square styrene strips evergreen 175 and 0.060 gussets as reinforcement, as I did for all the walls. Standing seam roofing. I cut the two lower roofs from metal siding sheet styrene, thinned the edges with a file, and cemented them in place. The two highest tipple roofs were cut from styrene sheet with 0.040 square ribs, evergreen 142, attached. These roofs are removable, the upper to see the shaft positioning pins when installing the model, and the lower for access to the coal bin for refilling. I attached 0.100 by 0.100 styrene strip to the underside of the roof to ensure a good fit. Design changes left gaps along the roof line of the left front wall. I made siding patches by pressing aluminum foil between two scraps of metal siding sheet styrene and a vise. Then I trimmed the foil and patched the gaps. Finishing the tipple shell. I painted the walls and roof with gray primer. lightened with an overspray of white paint. I printed cardstock stencil for the tipple sign on my computer and cut out the letters. Then I held the stencil against the siding and sprayed the lettering with engine black acrylic paint. I touched up the bridging and bleeding with concrete acrylic paint. I brush painted the Micro Engineering number 80-064 window frame light Tuscan oxide red, then I added clear styrene glazing and installed them. I weathered the tipple by dry brush concrete rail brown paint, then when dry, I followed with washes of rail brown and India ink, 2 teaspoons of ink to 1 cup of alcohol. I sealed the weathering with tester's dull coat, which dirtied the window glazing and hid the interior, anchoring the left end. Post assemblies for the temple overhang are 1/8-inch square strip wood with 1/16 by 1/8 cross bracing and number 5093 NBW castings, painted rail brown. I added wood grain to all strip wood with a razor saw blade, followed by brown and India ink washes. I built concrete footings from styrene. Then I positioned the tipple on the layout. I glued the top of the post assemblies to the tipple with CA glue. I made sure the posts were vertical before gluing the footings to the layout surface, following the prototype's lead. The prototype tipple is a wood timber structure sheathed in corrugated steel. I detailed the visible rear and left sides of the shaft interior to match. First, I glued more of the pressed aluminum foil siding to the rear shaft wall. I then added posts and cross bracing timbers. I notched the timbers to imply thin corrugated metal sheathing. Next, I finished a shaft entrance with a heavily weathered picket fence gate from the Central Valley Fence Kit, 1601. I sanded the backing rails thinner, then brushed the gate with concrete, rail brown, and grimy black paint. I glued a scale 2x4 wood strip diagonally across the back and attached the gates intentionally crooked to the shaft, timbers to match the prototype. I finished by gluing paper hinges stained with a brown marker in place. I cut and glued 7 1/8-inch square head frame beams going up the tipple wall above the shaft entrance. 3 are stacked together at the top and 2 each on the short walls to the front and rear of the shaft enclosure. The head frame main and side struts attach these posts. For the stairs, I brush painted Central Valley injection molded plastic treads 1602, rail brown, and randomly dry brush them with streaks of reefer white and grimy black. I built the platforms and railings from scribed sheet wood, 2x4, 2x6, and 4x4 strip wood. Sheave wheels and platform. I made sturdy brackets for the Grantline sheave wheels. I blackened 2 3/8-inch links of 3/64 brass rod for the axles. I centered and glued the wheels to the axles with CA and then unevenly brush painted the wheels and brackets rail brown and grimy black for a used industrial look. A pair of 1/8-inch strip wood beams support each sheave wheel and its brackets. The beams and another 2 at the front and rear of the platform rest on an unpainted 0.125 square styrene strip and the topmost head frame beam on the outside wall of the shaft enclosure. Next, I threaded each axle into its brackets and glued the brackets to their support beams. The platform is more than 6 feet above the layout room floor, so I glued just enough scribed sheet wood around the edge to give the illusion of flooring. I glue all wood to wood joints with yellow carpenter's glue, styrene to styrene with plastic cement, and styrene to wood with CA. Then I built the cable beam assembly above the platform from 1/8-inch square and 1/16 by 1/8 strip wood and number 5046 NBW castings. The angle iron details are paper strips. I finished off the platform with black and links of 1/32 brass rod and brown thread as railing. The timber frame. I scratch belt the head frame from strip wood and NBW castings prepared as before. Beginning with the side struts on the front and rear of the shaft closure, I angle cut 1/8-inch square strip wood struts per the plan. With the tipple firmly taped to a flat surface, my workbench is topped with laminate, I align the struts with the head frame beams on the tipple. Then I installed number 5046 NBW castings in the struts and glued them to the head frame beams. I added NBW castings to the front side, 1/16 by 1/8 cross braces, and glued them in place. I glued the rear side cross braces in place without NBW castings, since they aren't visible from normal viewing angles. I added their counterparts to the front of the struts. Main struts. The three main struts to the right of the shaft enclosure are double beamed, spaced a timber's width apart. I began by cutting top and bottom angles on 6/8-inch square wood strips. I made a fence template for my northwest short line chopper to ensure identical cuts. The prototype spliced timbers into struts more than 100 feet long. To replicate this, I lightly cut three strips on all four surfaces, 50 scale feet from the bottom, and the other three strips at 54 scale feet. I finished the wood differently above and below the cut. In addition to a light sanding, I added wood grain and applied a brown and India ink wash. I made sure the difference was sharply defined by the light cuts. I then paired up the 50 footers with the 54 footers, gluing the pairs together with 6 scale foot long 1/8-inch square strips as spacers. I added pairs of number 5046 NBW castings on either side of the cuts, since the bolts go through all three timbers at the splice. I added pairs of NBW castings on the opposite timber. The inner strut ties to the tipple on top only. The outer strut ties into the head frame beams on the tipple with horizontal beams bolted between their double timbers and with angled double beams from their base. I added these beams to the outer struts along with number 5093 NBW castings. I positioned but didn't glue the top two and bottom horizontal beams in place. Then I glued the struts to the head frame. I finished by cutting 1/16 by 3/32 cross braces, adding grant line number 5099 NBW castings, and attaching them. Hoist cable, motor, and pulley. I made the hoist cable by bonding the ends of a length of black carpet thread with CA, forming a loop. The cable is driven by a pulley wheel on the hoist motor. It loops over one sheave wheel at the top of the head frame and down the shaft, turns on the benchwork pulley beneath the layout, and returns up the shaft and over the other wheel. I salvaged two pulley wheels from a VCR. Their diameter roughly matches the distance between the sheave wheels. I cut the motor bracket from 1/16 aluminum sheet and drilled holes using the template with the Switchmaster 1001 stall motor kit. I bent the bracket, installed the motor, and attached the pulley wheel to the motor shaft with epoxy. Next, I aligned the motor bracket on the layout and screwed it to the layout surface with number 8 pan head wood screws. I lengthened and fished the motor wires through a 1/4-inch hole in the layout surface. I made the pulley bracket from the aluminum sheet, drilling 1/16 holes for the pulley, axle, and a pan head wood screw. I soldered a 1/16 brass rod inside a 3/32 brass tube to make the axle. I attached the wheel to the center of the axle with epoxy and slipped the axle into the bracket. I screwed the pulley to the underside of the layout. The hoist house. I built the hoist house from metal siding sheet styrene. The roof is .040, plain sheet, evergreen 9040, with .020 by .080 rafters, evergreen 124 under the eaves. I built hoist cable roof ports on the roof facing the tipple and made the roof removable from the bottom of the ports to the peak for easy threading of the hoist cable. After accurately positioning the hoist house over the motor, I glued links of .125 square styrene evergreen 186 to the layout surface to exactly fit its interior sides. This holds the removable hoist house in place. I made a foundation from .060 by .188 styrene evergreen 158. I trimmed the sills from the grant line numbers 5112 and 5251 window castings. The stack is black and quarter-inch brass tube, long enough to embed in the layout surface. I used scale 3-foot, 6-inch wide strips of tissue paper painted grimy black to simulate tar paper roofing. Hoist motor driver circuit. I built a simple circuit to alternately turn and stop the hoist motor. I got the perf board from Radio Shack. The rest of the items can be found at DigiKey. The printed circuit board layout, I cut the perf board using the circuit layout as a pattern, drilling 1/8-inch holes in the corners. I taped a copy of the circuit layout to the perf board, aligning the component holes on the diagram with the perf board holes. I taped this component side on one face of the perf board and the solder side on the other, with top edge, the 12-volt, aligned on both faces. As I inserted each component, I bent its leads to make the necessary connections as shown by the traces on the solder side. When I finished, soldered leads covered each circuit trace. I banded in of D1 and positive terminal of C1 are marked on the board layout. I inserted D1 to match, and C1's long lead through the positive hole. Make sure the dimple in the end of U1 matches the dimple on the board layout. Finally, I connected the circuit to my railroad 12-volt system to the positive terminal of a 12-volt supply, ground to the negative terminal, and M positive and M negative to the motor leads. The spinning wheels tell us that Monarch number 2 needs a cold turn today. Let's take a look at the railway post office conducted by Steve Oat. In praise of the Bishop Street branch, I read with interest the January 2023 issue of Model Railroad, particularly Meet the Bishop Street Branch by Lance Menheim. The first thing that jumped off the pages was the attention to detail. The buildings and the scenery put an operator at the location. You can almost feel the surroundings. The second thing that I learned is that an operator can experience meaningful operations without the layout being mammoth. Bigger is not better. The last point well taken was a suggestion to visit the actual site the layout depicts, if possible. Several members of the crew that built my layout visited the actual town, took photos, and measured buildings. The visit was a fantastic resource. Keep up the good work. That's from Mike Porter from Parkville, Missouri. Praise for Lance Menheim. I'm really enjoying Lance Menheim's Bishop Street branch. Nothing personal, but Model Railroad's recent project layouts were getting stale. Lance brings a fresh perspective to your project layout series, and his articles go beyond Layout Building 101. This makes the series more interesting to veteran model railroaders like myself. As from Joe Musgrove out of Little Rock, Arkansas. And speaking of Lance, I really enjoyed Tony Coster's most column, The Someday Central, in April. None of us are guaranteed a tomorrow. Time is a commodity that can never be recovered. If the peace motivates just one person to move from armchair to action, then it served a valuable person. That's from Lance Menheim, Silver Springs, Maryland. And I counter, a right in defense of Someday Central, model railroading. Tony Coster's sarcastic column reached one subscriber friend 2 days after his wife died. The couple waged a multi-year battle against a terminal disease. Near the end, they downsized, giving up forever his unfinished layout space. His closet full of unbuilt kits could trigger eye rolls from some, but those untouched treasures should be seen as testament. When personal pleasures beaconed, he considered and responded to family first. My friend never had a full operational layout, but he's a prize-winning modeler, and he assures me he still plans for his Someday Central. It's from Philip Paget out of Rockville, Maryland. I spy a mistake. The tool that Jeff Johnson described would be used by an optometrist, not an ophthalmologist. Track bending pliers in April. Optometrists are professionals who assemble and dispense eyeglasses. An ophthalmologist is a medical doctor who diagnoses and treats disorders of the eye. That's from Jonas Lechner out of Mount Vernon, Ohio. Correction, the photo of SPMX covered hopper number 7022 on page 15 of March issues was shot at Altoona, Pennsylvania, not Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania. Okay, how about a little bit from Ask Model Railroad? Question, I want to run 6-axle power in trains of 15 cars or so around a return loop without any type curves to it. What would be the recommended curve radius I should use, and how much space do I need? This is from Mike Bailey. The flippant answer is, how much space have you got? Modern diesel locomotives and the super long freight cars they pull today will look more realistic on the broadest curves you can give them to operate on. Even if your HO scale DDA40X will handle a 21-inch radius, it will look pretty silly with a fuel tank overhanging the inside of the curve. But seriously, the answer depends on what scale you're modeling in. You'll need a lot more space for a loop of track in O scale than you would for N. Since you didn't specify your preferred scale, I'll give you some guidelines for the most popular ones. In the book, Track Planning for Realistic Operation, John Armstrong recommends minimum curvatures of 11 inches for N scale, 18 inches for HO scale, 24 for S, and 35 for O. But instead, you want to run modern 6-axle power. Your minimum should be what Armstrong refers to as conventional curves, with broad curves or even larger being your goal. Broad curves for N scale would be 17 inch, HO would be 30 inch, S would be 41 inch, and O would be 58. So let's get back to your question. How much space for a loop of track using conventional or even broad curves? Again, I have to ask, how much space do you have? Because the bigger your layout, the broader curves you can have, the better your long rolling stock will look and run. If we're talking N scale, though I doubt we are, a turn back loop in conventional curves would be 28 inches across, which would fit comfortably on a 3-foot wide table. An N scale broad curve would take up 34 inches, which would be fine in a skosh over 3 foot. An HO scale conventional curve would be 4 foot across, a bit too large for the traditional 4x8 starter layout. At 60 inches across, a broad HO scale curve would require too long of a reach and distance for a solid table at this size or bigger. You'd have to think about a space for access in the middle of the layout. In S and O scale, you're definitely going to need the access for your layout from the middle rather than the edges. And that brings me to the reason I keep asking about your space. Beginning modelers often conceive their first layouts as occupying the center of the room, with walking space all around it. But an island configuration like this is about the most inefficient use of space. A 4x8 layout with 3 foot of aisle space on all four sides puts 32 square feet of layout in a 140 square foot room. Switch it to an around the walls design with 2 foot wide shelves around the perimeter, and the same 10x14 foot room yields 80 square foot of layout, which means a longer main line, more space for towns and sceneries, and a more prototypical run between stops. It gives you a better looking layout too, with backdrops behind your trains instead of having to look over at Bob and Chuck running their trains from the other side. And while a 4x8 layout can handle at most 21-inch curves, you could easily put 30 inches or even broader ones into the corners of that around-the-walls layout. So if it's broad curves you want, start thinking outside the box. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us for Model Railroading Magazine. My name is Kevin Harvey. Have a great day and keep model railroading.
You've been listening to The Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com, that's TRANES.com, in collaboration with the Audio Information Network of Colorado. If you enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aincolorado.org, where you can find more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to connect with us, feel free to give us a call at 303-786-7777. Thank you for listening.